over its human bounds, because to be human seems like a poor, sorry, miserable affair, limited by the senses, restricted by moralities and codes, defined by platitudes and isms. I am pouring the juice of the grape down my gullet, and I find wisdom in it, but my wisdom is not born of the grape. My intoxication owes nothing to wine. I want to make a detour of those lofty, arid mountain ranges where one dies of thirst and cold, that extra-temporal history, that absolute of time and space, where there exists neither man, beast, nor vegetation, where one goes crazy with loneliness, with language that is mere words, where everything is unhooked, ungeared, out of joint with the times. I want a world of men and women, of trees that do not talk, because there is too much talk in the world as it is, of rivers that carry you to places, not rivers that are legends, but rivers that put you in touch with other men and women, with architecture, religion, plants, animals, rivers that have boats on them, and in which men drown, drown not in myth and legend and books and dust of the past, but in time and space and history. I want rivers that make oceans, such as Shakespeare and Dante, rivers which do not dry up in the void of the past. Oceans, yes. Let us have more oceans, new oceans that blot out the past, oceans that create new geological formations, new topographical vistas and strange, terrifying continents, oceans that destroy and preserve at the same time, oceans that we can sail on, take off to new discoveries, new horizons. Let us have more oceans, more upheavals, more wars, more holocausts. Let us have a world of men and women with dynamos between their legs, a world of natural fury, of passion, action, drama, dreams, madness, a world that produces ecstasy and not dry farts. I believe that today more than ever, a book should be sought after, even if it has only one great page in it. We must search for fragments, splinters, toenails, anything that has ore in it, anything that is capable of resuscitating the body and soul. It may be that we are doomed, that there is no hope for us, any of us. But if that is so, then let us set up a last, agonizing, blood-curdling howl, a screech of defiance, a war-whoop. Away with lamentation, away with elegies and dirges, away with biographies and histories and libraries and museums. Let the dead eat the dead. Let us living ones dance about the rim of the crater, a last expiring dance. But a dance! I love everything that flows, said the great blind Milton of our times. I was thinking of him this morning when I awoke with a great bloody shout of joy. I was thinking of his rivers and trees and all that world of night which he is exploring. Yes, I said to myself, I too love everything that flows. Rivers, sewers, lava, semen, blood, bile, words, sentences. I love the amniotic fluid when it spills out of the bag. I love the kidney with its painful gallstones, its gravel and whatnot. I love the urine that pours out scalding and the clap that runs endlessly. I love the words of hysterics and the sentences that flow on like dysentery and mirror all the sick images of the soul. I love the great rivers like the Amazon and the Orinoco, where crazy men like Moravagine float on through dream and legend in an open boat and drown in the blind mouths of the river. I love everything that flows, even the menstrual flow that carries away the seed unfecund. I love scripts that flow, be they hieratic, esoteric, perverse, polymorph, or unilateral. I love everything that flows, everything that has time in it, and becoming, that brings us back to the beginning where there is never end, the violence of the prophets, the obscenity that is ecstasy, the wisdom of the fanatic, the priest with his rubber litany, the foul words of the whore, the spittle that floats away in the gutter, the milk of the breast, and the bitter honey that pours from the womb, all that is fluid, melting, dissolute, and dissolvent. All the pus and dirt that in flowing is purified, that loses its sense of origin, that makes the great circuit toward death and dissolution. The great, incestuous wish is to flow on, one with time, to merge the great image of the beyond with the here and now. A fatuous, suicidal wish that is constipated by words and paralyzed by thought. It was close to dawn on Christmas Day when we came home from the Rue d'Odessa with a couple of negresses from the telephone company. The fire was out, and we were all so tired that we climbed into bed with our clothes on. The one I had, who had been like a bounding leopard all evening, fell sound asleep as I was climbing over her. For a while I worked over her as one works over a person who has been drowned or asphyxiated. Then I gave it up and fell sound asleep myself. All during the holidays, we had champagne, morning, noon, and night, the cheapest and the best champagne. With the turn of the year, I was to leave for Dijon, where I had been offered a trivial post as exchange professor of English, one of those Franco-American amity arrangements which is supposed to promote understanding and goodwill between sister republics. Fillmore was more elated than I by the prospect. He had good reason to be. For me, it was just a transfer from one purgatory to another. There was no future ahead of me. There wasn't even a salary attached to the job. One was supposed to consider himself fortunate to enjoy the privilege of spreading the gospel of Franco-American amity. It was a job for a rich man's son. The night before I left, we had a good time. About dawn, it began to snow. We walked about from one quarter to another, taking a last look at Paris. Passing through the Rue Saint-Dominique, we suddenly fell upon a little square, and there was the Église Saint-Clotilde. People were going to Mass. Fillmore, whose head was still a little cloudy, was bent on going to Mass too, for the fun of it, as he put it. I felt somewhat uneasy about it. In the first place, I had never attended a Mass, and in the second place, I looked seedy and felt seedy. Fillmore, too, looked rather battered, even more disreputable than myself. His big slouch hat was on assways, and his overcoat was still full of sawdust from the last joint we had been in. However, we marched in. The worst they could do would be to throw us out. I was so astounded by the sight that greeted my eyes that I lost all uneasiness. It took me a little while to get adjusted to the dim light. I stumbled around behind Fillmore, holding his sleeve. A weird, unearthly noise assailed my ears, a sort of hollow drone that rose up out of the cold flagging. A huge, dismal tomb it was, with mourners shuffling in and out, a sort of antechamber to the world below. Temperature about 55 or 60 Fahrenheit. No music except this undefinable dirge manufactured in the sub-cellar like a million heads of cauliflower wailing in the dark. People in shrouds were chewing away with that hopeless, dejected look of beggars who hold out their hands in a trance and mumble an unintelligible appeal. That this sort of thing existed, I knew, but then one also knows that there are slaughterhouses and morgues and dissecting rooms. One instinctively avoids such places. In the street, I had often passed a priest with a little prayer book in his hands, laboriously memorizing his lines. Idiot, I would say to myself, and let it go at that. In the street, one meets with all forms of dementia, and the priest is by no means the most striking. 2,000 years of it has deadened us to the idiocy of it. However, when you are suddenly transported to the very midst of his realm, when you see the little world in which the priest functions like an alarm clock, you are apt to have entirely different sensations. For a moment, all this slaver and twitching of the lips almost began to have a meaning. Something was going on, some kind of dumb show which, not rendering me wholly stupefied, held me spellbound. All over the world, wherever there are these dim-lit tombs, you have this incredible spectacle, the same mean temperature, the same crepuscular glow, the same buzz and drone. All over Christendom, at certain stipulated hours, people in black are groveling before the altar where the priest stands up with a little book in one hand and a dinner bell or atomizer in the other and mumbles to them in a language which, even if it were comprehensible, no longer contains a shred of meaning. Blessing them, most likely. Blessing the country, blessing the ruler, blessing the firearms and the battleships and the ammunition and the hand grenades. Surrounding him on the altar are little boys, dressed like angels of the Lord who sing alto and soprano, innocent lambs. All in skirts, sexless, like the priest himself, who is usually flat-footed and nearsighted to boot. A fine epicene caterwauling. Sex in a jockstrap, to the tune of J. Maul. I was taking it in as best I could in the dim light, fascinating and stupefying at the same time. All over the civilized world, I thought to myself, all over the world. Marvelous. Rain or shine, hail, sleet, snow, thunder, lightning, war, famine, pestilence, makes not the slightest difference. Always the same mean temperature, the same mumbo-jumbo, the same high-laced shoes and the little angels of the Lord singing soprano and alto. Near the exit, a little slot box to carry on the heavenly work, so that God's blessing may rain down upon king and country and battleships and high explosives and tanks and airplanes, so that the worker may have more strength in his arms, strength to slaughter horses and cows and sheep, strength to punch holes in iron girders, strength to sew buttons on other people's pants, strength to sell carrots and sewing machines and automobiles, strength to exterminate insects and clean stables and unload garbage cans and scrub lavatories, strength to write headlines and chop tickets in the subway, strength, strength. All that lip-chewing and horn-swoggling just to furnish a little strength. We were moving about from one spot to another, surveying the scene with that clear-headedness which comes after an all-night session. We must have made ourselves pretty conspicuous, shuffling about that way with our coat collars turned up and never once crossing ourselves and never once moving our lips except to whisper some callous remark. Perhaps everything would have passed off without notice if Fillmore hadn't insisted on walking past the altar in the midst of the ceremony. He was looking for the exit, and he thought while he was at it, I suppose, that he would take a good squint at the Holy of Holies, get a close-up on it, as it were. We had gotten safely by and were marching toward a crack of light, which must have been the way out, when a priest suddenly stepped out of the gloom and blocked our path. Wanted to know where we were going and what we were doing. We told him politely enough that we were looking for the exit. We said exit because at the moment we were so flabbergasted that we couldn't think of the French for exit. Without a word of response, he took us firmly by the arm, and opening the door, a side door it was, he gave us a push and out we tumbled into the blinding light of day. It happened so suddenly and unexpectedly that when we hit the sidewalk, we were in a daze. We walked a few paces, blinking our eyes, and then instinctively we both turned round. The priest was still standing on the steps, pale as a ghost and scowling like the devil himself. He must have been sore as hell. Later, thinking back on it, I couldn't blame him for it. But at that moment, seeing him with his long skirts and the little skull cap on his cranium, he looked so ridiculous that I burst out laughing. I looked at Fillmore and he began to laugh too. For a full minute we stood there laughing right in the poor bugger's face. He was so bewildered, I guess, that for a moment he didn't know what to do. Suddenly, however, he started down the steps on a run, shaking his fist at us as if he were in earnest. When he swung out of the enclosure, he was on the gallop. By this time, some preservative instinct warned me to get a move on. I grabbed Fillmore by the coat sleeve and started to run. He was saying like an idiot, "No, no, I won't run." "Come on," I yelled. "We'd better get out of here. That guy's mad clean through." And off we ran, beating it as fast as our legs would carry us. On the way to Dijon, still laughing about the affair, my thoughts reverted to a ludicrous incident of a somewhat similar nature which occurred during my brief sojourn in Florida. It was during the celebrated boom when, like thousands of others, I was caught with my pants down. Trying to extricate myself, I got caught, along with a friend of mine, in the very neck of the bottle. Jacksonville, where we were marooned for about 6 weeks, was practically in a state of siege. Every bum on earth, and a lot of guys who had never been bums before, seemed to have drifted into Jacksonville. The YMCA, the Salvation Army, the firehouses and police stations, the hotels, the lodging houses, everything was full up. Complet, absolutely. And signs everywhere to that effect. The residents of Jacksonville had become so hardened that it seemed to me as if they were walking around in coats of mail. It was the old business of food again, food and a place to flop. Food was coming up from below in trainloads, oranges and grapefruit and all sorts of juicy edibles. We used to pass by the freight sheds looking for rotten fruit, but even that was scarce. One night, in desperation, I dragged my friend Joe to a synagogue during the service. It was a Reformed congregation, and the rabbi impressed me rather favorably. The music got me too, that piercing lamentation of the Jews. As soon as the service was over, I marched to the rabbi's study and requested an interview with him. He received me decently enough until I made clear my mission. Then he grew absolutely frightened. I had only asked him for a handout on behalf of my friend Joe and myself. You would have thought, from the way he looked at me, that I had asked to rent the synagogue as a bowling alley. To cap it all, he suddenly asked me point blank if I was a Jew or not. When I answered no, he seemed perfectly outraged. Why, pray, had I come to a Jewish pastor for aid? I told him naively that I had always had more faith in the Jews than in the Gentiles. I said it modestly, as if it were one of my peculiar defects. It was the truth, too. But he wasn't a bit flattered. No, siree. He was horrified. To get rid of me, he wrote out a note to the Salvation Army people. "That's the place for you to address yourself," he said, and brusquely turned away to tend his flock. The Salvation Army, of course, had nothing to offer us. If we had had a quarter apiece, we might have rented a mattress on the floor, but we hadn't a nickel between us. We went to the park and stretched ourselves out on a bench. It was raining, and so we covered ourselves with newspapers. Weren't there more than a half hour, I imagine, when a cop came along, and without a word of warning, gave us such a sound fanning that we were up and on our feet in a jiffy, and dancing a bit too, though we weren't in any mood for dancing. I felt so goddamned sore and miserable, so dejected, so lousy, after being whacked over the ass by that half-witted bastard, that I could have blown up the city hall. The next morning, in order to get even with these hospitable sons of bitches, we presented ourselves bright and early at the door of a Catholic priest. This time I let Joe do the talking. He was Irish, and he had a bit of a brogue. He had very soft blue eyes, too, and he could make them water a bit when he wanted to. A sister in black opened the door for us. She didn't ask us inside, however. We were to wait in the vestibule until she went and called for the good father. In a few minutes he came, the good father, puffing like a locomotive. And what was it we wanted, disturbing his likes at that hour of the morning? Something to eat and a place to flop, we answered innocently. And where did we hail from, the good father wanted to know at once. From New York. From New York, eh? Then you'd better be getting back there as fast as you can, me lads, and without another word the big, bloated, turnip-faced bastard shoved the door in our face. About an hour later, drifting around helplessly like a couple of drunken schooners, we happened to pass by the rectory again. So help me God if the big, lecherous-looking turnip wasn't backing out of the alley in a limousine. As he swung past us, he blew a cloud of smoke into our eyes, as though to say, "That for you." A beautiful limousine it was, with a couple of spare tires in the back and the good father sitting at the wheel with a big cigar in his mouth. Must have been a Corona Corona, so fat and luscious it was. Sitting pretty he was, and no two ways about it. I couldn't see whether he had skirts on or not. I could only see the gravy trickling from his lips, and the big cigar with that 50-cent aroma. All the way to Dijon, I got to reminiscing about the past. I thought of all the things I might have said and done, which I hadn't said or done, in the bitter, humiliating moments when just to ask for a crust of bread is to make yourself less than a worm. Stone sober as I was still smarting from those old insults and injuries. I could still feel that whack over the ass which the cop gave me in the park, though that was a mere bagatelle, a little dancing lesson, you might say. All over the States I wandered, and into Canada and Mexico. The same story everywhere. If you want bread, you've got to get in harness, get in lockstep. Over all the earth, a gray desert, a carpet of steel and cement, production, more nuts and bolts, more barbed wire, more dog biscuits, more lawnmowers, more ball bearings, more high explosives, more tanks, more poison gas, more soap, more toothpaste, more newspapers, more education, more churches, more libraries, more museums, forward. Time presses. The embryo is pushing through the neck of the womb, and there's not even a gob of spit to ease the passage. A dry, strangulating birth, not a wail, not a chirp. Salut au monde. salute of 21 guns bombinating from the rectum. I wear my hat as I please, indoors or out, said Walt. That was a time when you could still get a hat to fit your head.